Blog Talk Radio.
And if you're involved in anything that I'm about ready to tell you, then you need to tell me, okay? Your mom's dead, okay? Now, what I want to ask you is, your mom's passed away, okay? And she's deceased, all right? Now, what I want to ask you, did you have involvement in this? Okay.
Hang on,
listen to me for just a second, okay? What happened with your mom that night?
I don't know.
Okay, just listen to me, okay, sweetheart? You know what happened to your mom, okay? And I know that you know.
You think that it's me? Why would you think that it's me? I have always loved my mom. My mom and I are best friends.
Listen to me. Please don't get yourself in this hole, and that's what you're doing.
And that is a clip courtesy of HBO from the upcoming HBO documentary, Mommy, Dead, and Dearest. It will debut on May 15th. Good evening. My name is Tricia Griffith. Welcome to Web Sleuths Radio, and I am thrilled beyond anything you can think of to have our next guest with us today. This is the director of Mommy, Dead, and Dearest. Please welcome Aaron Carr. Aaron, thank you for joining us tonight. I really appreciate it. Oh, are you there? Let's see. Oh, hold on just a second. Sorry, you got accidentally switched into mute mode. Sorry, Aaron. All right, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, okay, good. Sorry about that. It's just a technical thing. We're not that technical because we're usually drinking when we're doing the show. So do keep that in mind at all times. Aaron, this is not your first entrance into the world of crime as far as a documentary. You did another documentary that our Web Sleuths members will remember, this particular case. Let's start with that documentary, and then we'll work up to the Dee Dee Blanchard and Gypsy Rose Blanchard documentary. What was your first one?
First of all, I wanted to say, now that I'm not muted, I'm so thrilled to be here. I'm a big fan of Web Sleuths. Allison Byrne, my co-producer, and I, we check it on the regular. It's a fascinating and like really important community, and so I really appreciate being in, you know, being asked to speak with you. The first documentary was called Thought Crimes: The Case of the Cannibal Cop. And, you know, I think I'm kind of like a lot like the Web Sleuths. Like, basically, I was a person that read about this case. It was a New York City police officer that was convicted of conspiracy to kidnap, rape, torture, and eat young women. He was a fantasist. He was somebody that was obsessed with thinking about killing and eating women he knew. And he said that it was all sort of a fantasy, and that he was never going to harm anybody, that he was completely harmless. And so I took it upon myself to start visiting him in prison at a federal facility in New York where I live to sort of figure out what happened.
And what did happen? I know he was convicted. And when you look at it face value, it's like, God, I'd hate for anybody to read some of the, you know, weird things I've written. Obviously, I've never written anything like that. But do you think that was his map to killing and eating people, or was it really truly his fantasy and he just got caught and thrown in jail by the thought police?
Well, I mean, it's a great question. It's one that the film explores over the course of, I think it's like, you know, 84 minutes. And, you know, mm-hmm. I think that it was really scary for people to see that a New York City police officer was having these thoughts. But the thing mm-hmm. is, he did not show up at the door. He did not have the chloroform. He had handcuffs, but, you know, that was a part of his work sort of attire. I mean, if I were pursuing him, if I were investigating the case and like choosing to prosecute him, there would have had to be more overt action. And a lot of people will, you know, basically would, like, if I talk to them about this, would yell at me. Like, how far does a person mm-hmm. have to do in the act of committing a violence in order to get caught? And the thing is, like, I believe in personal liberty. And if there's a question mm-hmm. of that he was not going to do it, that man, however sick the thoughts are, does not belong in prison. And, you know, I think that it's just, you know, we put people in cages very quickly, and there's a lot of evil that happens in this world, but we need to really be thoughtful about and sort of like have all the information before we put people in prison for the rest of their lives.
Exactly. And that was his whole defense was, hey, I'm just writing down these twisted, sick thoughts. Don't convict me for thinking. And he was convicted for thinking. And the deal is, we'll never really know if he was going to go out and do anything or not. And probably they were thinking better safe than sorry, but that's not how the justice system is supposed to work. So where can we get this documentary?
It's on work. Yeah, like it's just an ethical thing. But I think like when we're late at night looking at when we're looking at the forum, we're looking into crimes, like how far are we away from Gill Valley? You know what I mean? It's an interesting question.
It's a very interesting question, and I was just thinking today, if something happened to me, who would clean out my cache of history? You know, because it would look so freaky. It's mortifying. But I don't mean to end up on sites like that have adult men dressed as babies hanging from their nipples by fish hooks. It just ends up there. I start out looking for something normal, and it just veers to this sick, twisted area. Erin, where can we find this documentary?
Yeah, of course. So the film is on HBO, and it is also, if you don't have HBO, it's on Amazon. And you can just type in Thought Crimes, and it's available to be downloaded. And, yeah, it's really – I would love to talk with people about it. I mean, it was my life for a really, really long time. And so, yes, I was glad when it was over that I didn't have to be looking at cannibal porn and, like, thinking about all that stuff all the time. It holds such a very, you know, a very special place in my heart.
About the man that was convicted, what did you think of him personally? Did he give you the creeps?
So we spent an enormous, enormous amount of time together. You know, he got out of prison, and I believe in the sort of a cinema verite approach to filmmaking, which means following action, having a camera there for many, many hours, seeing what's happening. And he got more comfortable with my DP, Brian, that's the cinematographer for the film. You know, I think that he is a fairly conflicted figure, but, you know, we had an issue in that he did not like the film. He did not think it was a fair representation of the case. You know, I wholeheartedly disagree, but it was just, it was troubling when he didn't like it. But it's still hard for me to talk about. It's, you know, it makes me feel upset that he's been slighted by this process, because, you know, he chose to work with me. He had a lot of other outlets to pick from. I had a film on HBO because he agreed to give me access. And when a subject or, you know, a human being that you spend a lot of time with doesn't like it, it's you know, it causes a lot of sort of intense feelings.
Well, exactly, because you're trying to portray the story truthfully. And to have the subject of the story say, hey, it's not, that would make me feel awful. But I do think you have to keep in mind, he probably doesn't want his story represented as horrible as it was, the thoughts being as horrible as they are. So he's trying to backpedal everything to make it seem like he was just a normal guy with these weird thoughts. But let's move on to your next documentary. Now, this one, it's the HBO documentary, Mommy, Dead, and Dearest. It debuts on May 15th. It's about a woman and her daughter, and the woman has Munchausen by proxy. And it's very interesting that this show airs the day after Mother's Day. Brilliant planning by somebody. Was that you, Erin?
It was not me. It was somebody wonderful and very smart at HBO.
That's been a very good job. Now, Web Sleuth members will remember Dee Dee Blanchard and Gypsy Rose. It was a horrific case. Dee Dee, the mom, ended up murdered, and her daughter, who was in a wheelchair and sick and was, I think, 14 or 15, I mean, she looked like a little elf, just as frail as can be. She's missing. And everybody is, oh, my gosh, you know, poor Gypsy Rose, she's going to be dead. Come to find out, the whole thing was a scam. Dee Dee Blanchard had been making Gypsy Rose Lee sick, had been shaving her head, had been making her sit in a wheelchair her whole life. I think she was in a wheelchair for 17 years. And
right.
it was Gypsy Rose and her boyfriend that she met on the internet ended up killing Dee Dee. And now let's back way up here. How did you get this subject? How did you have access to Gypsy Rose? Because, again, this would be somebody I think a lot of people are knocking on her door.
Right. I love hearing other people explain the story because it's never the same thing. It's always just kind of like people exploring what happened here. And so, I was with my HBO supervising producer at a party, and she said, I'm interested in why people confess online. And so immediately when somebody like that says, like, I'm interested in something, you're immediately going to pay attention. And so I was working with Allison, who I mentioned at the top, and I said, let's find 5 to 10 stories where people confessed online. And she found this thought catalog piece about a young woman named Gypsy Rose. And I started reading it, and I was like, I don't understand what this is saying. Did she not need the wheelchair? And I just was utterly sort of baffled by it. And then as I read more and, like, basically thought more about it, I was like, I have never heard of a documentary like this. This would be a coup if I could ever get access. And so I sent Gypsy Rose Blanchard a letter in the mail. I found out her prison address. I contacted her lawyer, as is appropriate. At the time, she was facing a potential death sentence. And so, you know, it was this very slow but sure process. And so she sent me a letter back, and she said, Miss Aaron, she's from the South. She's very polite. She said, you know, I would like to speak with you, but I have to talk with my lawyer. That's what I'm just assuming that she sort of talked, but she sent me a letter. And I said, okay, this is great. This is wonderful. Maybe this can happen. And I got a letter back from her I think it was like the next week, where she said, you know, my lawyer, Mike Stanfield, has said that it is not the right time to speak with you. So that is so typical. You have to understand that a person is facing a criminal justice investigation, that their first priority is not going to be to talk to you. So it was this super long, super slow process of determining access and getting comfortable with everybody involved in the case.
And so it eventually all came together, thank goodness, and we have this great documentary to show for it. Let's talk about the history of Dee Dee Blanchard and Gypsy Rose, her daughter. Now, a lot of people don't know that Dee Dee was actually married for a while, and Gypsy Rose's father is now in the picture. But let's start at the very beginning. Dee Dee has this little baby, and according to her husband, ex-husband now, it started when Gypsy was a tiny baby. She's got something wrong. She has seizure. How did the seed get planted and continue into this huge Munchausen by proxy situation?
Totally. That's a really good question. And so, you know, Dee Dee growing up in Louisiana was always kind of a charismatic, funny girl. She always seemed to have some serious health concerns, whether it be her foot or her back. She got into a car accident. You know, Dee Dee was always complaining about some sort of ailment, excuse me. And so when she met Rod, her Gypsy's father, they dated for a little while, and she immediately became pregnant. What I have heard, and this is, you know, this is more gossip than fact. I wasn't able to verify this, but basically it was Dee Dee's intention to immediately get pregnant, and sort of the rest is history. She became pregnant. Rod is a wonderful, down-to-earth Southern boy, and he said, okay, we're going to get married. But when they were married for a very short amount of time, and you know, I think he just woke up one morning and he was like, I don't know this person. This is not the right person for me to be dating. And so, he left 3 months into, I think, the pregnancy. And so it just was this very sort of chaotic time where they were not together, even though they had just gotten together. And when Gypsy Rose was born, I think Dee Dee said, you know, it's me and you versus the world. There was this mentality. And, you know, she was a very, very, very small child and immediately had health problems, breathing problems, couldn't sleep, you know, was cognitively slower. But again, this is all Dee Dee telling people this. Nobody really knew if it was for certain.
And it just kind of, it absolutely did snowball into what we have now. And looking back on Dee Dee Blanchard and Gypsy Rose, by the way, we have Aaron Carr on. Aaron Carr directed the new HBO documentary that is going to air the day after Mother's Day. It's called Mommy Dead and Dearest. May 15th is when that will air. And it did evolve into this big Munchausen by proxy. And looking back on it, Dee Dee had all the classic signs. If a doctor didn't agree with her diagnosis of Gypsy, she would find another doctor. She insisted that Gypsy Rose had muscular dystrophy, and she never did. And I believe that was one of the reasons for the wheelchair. But what's interesting is in all these years of going to all these doctors and working the system, Dee Dee knew how to work the system to make sure she didn't get caught. There was one person. Wasn't there one person that said, you know, this isn't right? And now he feels guilty for not stepping up. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, you're referring to a particular doctor, and I think your listeners, you know, hopefully they tune in for the film, but there was somebody that we were able to speak to that was a neurologist, and he did some tests with Gypsy, and he saw that the muscle mass in her legs was very irregular for someone who had muscular dystrophy. Like, you know, it did not show signs of atrophy. It showed that she was, you know, her legs were strong enough to walk. That alone is very shocking. And then he wrote a note to her GP, her general practitioner, saying, I think something wrong is happening here. And, like, I want to be really clear. It's not like, oh, Gypsy would walk in town sometimes. You know, she would use crutches or, you know, she was seen as disabled, but, like, maybe sometimes she could walk. Gypsy Rose was never, ever seen outside of a wheelchair. People thought she was mentally and physically completely handicapped. Her, the best friends of the family, never even thought for a million years that she could walk. It was one of the most shocking revelations in the community how well the scam was sort of perpetuated. This was not a short con. This was for years, and it would have gone on forever, I think, had Dee Dee not been murdered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it. Wonder how long Gypsy Rose would have gone along with it, because in reality, when her mother was murdered, I believe she was 24 years old, not a young teenager like her mother claimed her to be. Let's talk about Dee Dee and this mass deception. I'm sure it was fascinating uncovering all of this, but it started looking at the documentary. It started after Hurricane Katrina. Did they really lose their house in Hurricane Katrina, or was that made up?
That's so. I mean, I really wanted to know that, because that to me felt like the complete start of how this happened. Like, basically, there was a hurricane that devastated the United States, and the fact that this woman would use it as a ruse to sort of perpetuate a scam seems so shocking to me. So I digged and I digged and I digged, and I worked with this amazing researcher, Allison, and we were able to confirm that Gypsy and Dee Dee were living in basically a county that was affected by Hurricane Katrina, and they did move into a shelter. So while there is a ton of evil that's happening in this movie, that is one of the only truths that we were able to verify.
And boy, did Dee Dee use that to her advantage. And we're going to get into those details in just a little bit. We're talking with Aaron Carr. She is the director of the HBO documentary Mommy Dead and Dearest. It will debut on May 15th on HBO. And our wonderful, incredible Bessie, my producer, has a few questions for you, Aaron. So I'm going to turn it over to Bessie for a little bit. Bessie, your time is yours, my dear. The floor is yours.
Of course.
Are you there?
Well, I was just wondering. Yeah, I'm here. Okay. Erin, before Gypsy was born, did Dee Dee show any signs of Munchausen herself?
Sure. She did work in the medical profession, which is a hallmark sign of a Munchausen by proxy or Munchausen perpetrator. I think she was seen as a candidate for this. And like when we're talking about Munchausen, it is so, so rare. But I've spoken to many doctors. No one has ever seen this type. This is one of the craziest Munchausen cases I think people have ever sort of really like heard about.
That is, yeah, that's pretty wild. But I was just wondering, you know, did she show signs of what we might call, you know, or used to call a hypochondriac, where she faked illnesses herself?
Yeah, I mean, she did. She did fake illnesses. I think that her mother also was either histrionic or had a, you know, fairly consistent history of feigning or existing in illnesses. And it's kind of learned behavior. And there is a, like, I do believe that Dee Dee Blanchard, that this is a total, this is my thought, this has not been verified, this has not been, I can't know this. I do think that she was involved in her mother's murder, I mean, her mother's death. I think that, you know, she was supposed to be taking care of her mother, and she didn't.
Uh-oh.
And the family believes that too.
Can I touch on that? Go ahead, Bessie.
Well, this is kind of goes in a different direction. But when it came to evidence, I mean, I know after Katrina, so much evidence was destroyed. I mean, in New Orleans, we had so many criminal records that were destroyed because they were stored in a basement. But from what I understand from some of the notes, in this case, the evidence survived. And I just find that very interesting. And I just wondered if you had any comments about that.
Totally. So a lot of the medical records were destroyed, but we were able, when they moved to Missouri, we were able to get a HIPAA form signed and have access to Gypsy's medical records as she requested for us. So, but yeah, from early childhood, you know, that's where we could really find out, you know, with the leukemia, was there ever any sort of trace of that, which I don't think there was. You know, it started, the medical records that are available to us are only when she is, you know, if she's in Missouri and when she's older.
I wanted to go back to what you just said a moment ago, Erin, because I'm sitting here with my mouth open. You think that Dee Dee, and this is just your opinion, had something to do with her mother's death, Gypsy Rose's grandmother. She was taking care of her, and her family thinks that as well. What makes you think this? What did she die of? Just give us a little bit of background, because I find this fascinating.
Sure. So Dee Dee was taking care of her mother. Her name was Emma Pete, P-I-T-R-E. And, you know, she was, you know, well-known around the community, but a pretty ill person. And so the story is, you know, Christy, who is Gypsy's stepmom, I'm sorry, there's a lot of names going around, so I'm trying to be as simple as possible. But basically that Dee Dee was taking care of her mom, and the mom said, I really need some food. I'm not feeling well. I'm, you know, basically complaining to her. And Dee Dee, exerting control, exerting dominance, said, oh, no, you're not going to get your food right now. And later that day, her mother died. I believe it was a heart attack. And so that's crazy. And then you go to this next thing. The dad remarried a friend of the family. You see her in our film, and she says that her and Dee Dee hated each other. They did not get along. Gypsy and Dee Dee were living there. And all of a sudden, one day, she was stricken. She couldn't get out of bed. She felt completely, completely sick. And it was later found out that Dee Dee was putting Roundup in her food. And when she was confronted about it, she fled.
And that's when she fled. Roundup being the weed killer.
Right.
And, that's just awful. Boy, this woman was deeply, deeply disturbed. So she goes to Louisiana. She actually does have losses connected to Hurricane Katrina. And she moves away from there. And it's the next community that Dee Dee Blanchard goes to that really embraces her, where we find a lot of the stories about Dee Dee and Gypsy's relationship. Where did she move to, Erin?
So they first moved to a city called Aurora, Missouri, but then
mm-hmm.
they basically enrolled in a program through the hospital that Gypsy was being treated at, and they were qualified for Habitat for Humanity House. And this was the answer to Dee Dee's prayers. Dee Dee did not work, taking care of Gypsy was a full-time job, according to her, and so they had very, very... They had no money, and so when this was offered, they just took advantage of it. And so Dee Dee basically went from somebody who stole money from her parents, stole checkbooks, stole things, was photographed by the police officers. There were warrants out for her. She went to Missouri and she changed her complete identity. She became very loving. She became very sweet. She baked goods for the neighbors. Her physical appearance changed. She looked more matronly. She said that she told neighbors that she had to leave Louisiana because Gypsy's father was quote unquote after her. It was a complete and total transformation. She had decided that she needed to be viewed in a very, very specific way to get what she wanted.
And did she get what she wanted? They received not only the house from Habitat for Humanity, but they got a van, they got trips to Disney World, and Gypsy Rose liked to dress up. She liked to wear a Cinderella costume? And Dee Dee, it seems like, embraced this. Yeah, she had a ton of costumes. Anyway, Dee Dee keeps her daughter down as far as her age. She makes her pretend that she's a lot younger than she is. She pulled it off beautifully because when you see in the documentary on May 15th on HBO, she looks like she's, 8 or 9 years old. To me, she looks very young,
totally.
And she's 24.
Totally.
She has a high-pitched voice, very tiny, tiny, tiny person. Let's talk about Gypsy's life. As she gets older, she goes through her teenage years. Now she's in her 20s, still pretending to be a young teenager. She starts reaching out on Facebook, and she starts trying to have a life, doesn't she?
Right. So, I think that one of the most interesting parts of this case is that, Dee Dee and Gypsy were best friends. They really got along. I think that it's easy for you and I to have this conversation and talk about Dee Dee as this sort of evil person. But, in Munchausen by cases, it's abuse, but it's also, she was always around her, always taking care of her. Gypsy felt so cared for by her mother. But as Gypsy got older, as she tried to claim, even a modicum of independence from this person, Dee Dee became more oppressive, more threatening. I'm sure it was so shocking for Gypsy to sort of interact with. She couldn't go to school. She couldn't go to friends. She was only allowed to watch Disney films. I mean, that's crazy. There's a big question for me about, if Dee Dee was this protective, why was she able to have a phone? Why was she able to have a computer? If Dee Dee was this controlling, it's one of the things that it's a little hard to talk to Gypsy about, because I think that in her mind, in her narrative, her mother was very, obviously very abusive. But, you know, there is a couple of inconsistencies. And I say that as not ever blaming the victim, but just as a journalist trying to seek out the truth and the fact of the matter.
Right. And so you're right. She did have a phone. Gypsy had a phone. She had some access to Facebook. But didn't wouldn't she get mad and take that away from her? Maybe it was a controlling thing, do you think?
That's a hypothesis that I think could... I mean, I think that it's just so boring to be in a house all the day long. And so she probably did what any kid does, but says, Mom, I really want this. Mom, I really want this. Mom, I really
want
this.
Right. Drove her mom
and like,
crazy.
You know, we are not, they are still a mother daughter. And so I think Dee Dee had access to her Facebook accounts and they shared a Facebook account. But, you know, Gypsy had these secret accounts where she would talk with her boyfriend and, you know, I think that Dee Dee thought that she can control Gypsy as she entered adulthood, but that was not the case.
And so now we know that Dee Dee is using Gypsy Rose as a pawn, basically, to get attention, to get the things she wants, needs. I mean, there was always a fundraiser. People were always bringing them food. In turn, she would do things. Dee Dee would do things for the neighborhood. She'd get a screen and show a movie on the side of the house. And, you know, everybody was involved with Dee Dee and Gypsy, and they were well-loved. And like I said earlier, she was able to go take Gypsy Rose to these, you know, Disneyland or Disney World and these places where you dress up and pretend to be somebody else. I don't know what they call it. It's like Comic-Con, but not comic book stuff. Anyway, all of this was going on. Dee Dee is still saying she has muscular dystrophy. She has trouble breathing. She can't keep food down. She's had leukemia. Now, Gypsy Rose is talking with a guy, and this was her boyfriend. And this guy, Nicholas Godejean, I think is how you pronounce his name. And they start a real intense affair over Facebook. They're not meeting up or anything. Or are they? Did they ever meet up before the murder? I don't know.
So they met on a site called ChristianDatingForFree.com. They used the messaging within the app. Then they moved to text message. And they immediately decided that they would be in a relationship. And so then it was a relationship primarily of Skyping back and forth. And Gypsy did meet up with Nicholas before the murder. They met and they went and saw the film Cinderella together with Dee Dee, even though they were supposed to not have known each other. So it's just so strange. It's still to me, knowing the case so well, even hearing these words out of my mouth, it's like, you know, Cinderella, and like they met on Skype, and they talk on Skype.
And the bloody murder, it just doesn't go hand in hand with what you're talking about. So
exactly. They
meet up, they're sneaking out, and I would imagine her boyfriend Nicholas is saying, you know, you're not sick, you can walk, and she's probably getting angry at her mother for keeping her down, for keeping her in. You can just imagine the back and forth between them. At what point do they start to plot and decide that they're going to break away? What happens there?
So I think that basically when I just mentioned the Cinderella, and you know, the Cinderella screening, that did not go well. Dee Dee met Nicholas. She was instantly disturbed by him. I do not think he made a good impression. You know, Gypsy basically orchestrated this date so that Nick was a random person in the theater and they just so happened to meet there. Because she was under her mom sort of lock and key, she would have no way to meet this. So it was a very poorly sort of thought out plan. They met, Dee Dee hated him, and Gypsy, this is one of the only things in her life that ever gave her joy, you know, for the last, you know, 3 or 4 years, and so she couldn't lose him. She absolutely could not lose him. And so her mom was not going to let them be together. So at first, she hatched this plan, basically that she was going to get pregnant by him, and then the mom, you know, basically her mom would say, you know, you have to keep the baby, and I will accept Nick because I have to. That didn't work out. It was not seen as a viable plan. Nick said, you know, I'm not ready to be a father. But then the next plan B is to murder her mother? Like,
I don't mean to laugh. It's not funny. It's just so outrageous.
Right.
So yeah, they plan this murder. Continue that story.
So what, you know, in the film, she, you know, and this is, nobody has ever done a video interview with her. We did it for 2.5 hours. And I said, you know, it's really important that we talk to you exactly about what happened in your own words. Mm-hmm. And so it's just this, it was one of the most surreal aspects of my life. And so basically what happened is they started talking about her escape from her mom. And, you know, the mom had drawn up paperwork that says that, you know, she is in control of Gypsy's life because Gypsy is mentally handicapped. It's crazy that mm-hmm. paperwork was ever signed. So really it effectively removed her ability to escape. And like a lot of audience members are going to be like, how, you know, why would you kill her? Like, why not escape? So that's a reason that we need to be really clear about. And so they called the murder Plan B. And Nicholas mm-hmm. is somebody who is very severely mentally ill, and he has multiple personalities that live within him, and one is very violent. And the violent multiple personality is called Victor. And, you know, they were both very, very happy that Victor, quote unquote, could take care of the mom. And mm-hmm. that's just kind of what they started to talk about. Her Gypsy stole money from her mother. She bought Nick a bus ticket. He texted her when he got to Springfield, and it was a kitchen knife that was used. Nick texted her to get the knife out, get the plastic gloves out that she had bought, open the door, give him the knife, and then hide in the bathroom while he stabbed her to death.
Oh my God, I can't. Does Dee Dee talk, excuse me, does Gypsy Rose talk to you about that? What did she hear? What was she thinking? Did she regret it? Was she excited? Did she ever explain any of her emotions while this was going on?
Yes, she did. I felt it was very important to put the audience there that night. Because, you know, we can vilify Dee Dee, but no one deserves to be stabbed like that in the dead of night. You know, it's one of the most gruesome ways to die. And I think that, you know, in order for us to understand and truly, like, really get to this story, we had to be very, very clear about the murder. And I think some people, potentially not like us, like web sleuths, will, you know, might find that it is too graphic, it's exploitative, you know, she's a victim, you know, why do you show crime scene photos? You know, this is a human life, and we need to know that it's not Disney movies, it's not fairy tales, somebody's life is gone.
Mm-hmm. And you have to do something that is that graphic to get that message across. This is,
you know,
real
that's
life,
my
this
feeling.
Is what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
This is what happens. So they escape, but before they do, again, this just gets weirder and weirder. Before we go on, in case anybody's just joining us, I'm talking with Aaron Carr. Aaron is the director of this amazing new HBO documentary, Mommy, Dead, and Dearest. It will debut on May 15th. And now we have Gypsy Rose and her boyfriend, Nicholas. They've killed her mother, Dee Dee. But then they do something really stupid. They post on Facebook, and I believe this was under Gypsy's account, they posted "bitch is dead," and mm-hmm. then later, and excuse me, I'm warning you now, I'm going to say swear words, so if you melt at the sound of a swear word, just be ready. They post this on the Facebook page. I fucking slashed that fat pig and raped her sweet, innocent daughter. Her scream was so fucking loud, LOL. So now people are reading this, and they're freaking out, you know. But, oh, my right. God, where's Gypsy? How did the neighbors go break in? Did the police come? How did this all come together, and how did they finally realize that Gypsy was actually a part of this?
Yeah, of course. The timeline is really interesting. So Nicholas and Gypsy take a Greyhound bus back to Wisconsin, where Nick is from. They get picked up by his mom. They act like nothing has happened. They spend time together. They watch Beauty and the Beast. And, you know, she wants somebody to find her mom. She doesn't want the body to rot in the house. She decides that it would be best for her to post on Facebook a status that gets the police's attention. But, you know, she's always convinced that they won't, you know, they won't arrest her. They would just arrest Nick and, you know, it would be fine. Okay, so they post what, you know, that really scary thing that you just said. They post it on Facebook. And Gypsy, and this isn't in the movie, continues to Google her mother's name, her dead mother's name. Dee Dee Blanchard. She Googles, I think, 6 or 7 times. She's trying to find out, you know, if they have found her mother's body yet. I'm sure she's reading the Facebook comments. So there are neighbors and friends named Kim and David Blanchard. I swear they are of no relation, even though they have the same last name, which is crazy. And they basically say, I'm going to go find out what happened. And so David, you know, basically goes in the house through a window and walks around. He says nothing is out of the ordinary. The police are then called because they think it's a prank. They want to see what's going. They open up the house, and there is Dee Dee. The blankets have been piled on top of her. Her neck has been slashed. Her back has been cut. And they are just totally, they're just bewildered. Where is the little girl in the wheelchair? Why are all the wheelchairs there? And then why was this neighbor randomly going into the house in a murder investigation? They immediately, like, cleared the scene, took pictures. I have all of the crime scene photos. They inventoried everything, and they set out to find out who did this. And so what they did is they traced the IP address of that Facebook confession, and they traced it back to a town called Big Bend, Wisconsin. And Wisconsin has been in the true crime communities a lot lately because of Making a Murderer. So everybody was immediately like, oh, gosh, Wisconsin, come on, what's going on over there? And I went to school in Wisconsin, so it makes me laugh. And they traced it back to the Go to John house. They a team surrounded that house and brought Nick and Gypsy in.
They were able to find him through an IP address. I'm telling you, people, you cannot hide when you're on the Internet. You think you can, but you can't. Now, at the beginning of the show, I played a little snippet of the interrogation, and you do have a lot more of it in your documentary. At the beginning, Gypsy tried to act like she didn't know, and the detective is almost fatherly toward her, right? He's just very great, just very kind, and talks in a soft voice, but he's very firm as well. She finally admits to everything, correct? Obviously. Mm-hmm.
So I have a very different interpretation of that interview. He feels really gruff to me. He feels very very intense. She is basically talking as if she's a child. She has been put in the child room. You see that there is a stuffed blue fish next to her. It's all very bizarre. The person that got the really nice investigator, the really sort of thoughtful investigator, was the detective that interviewed Nick. I think that Detective Hancock, the detective that interviewed Gypsy, he knew that she was involved, and she consistently lied to him about her involvement. You know, and Detective Hancock does not like to be lied to.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's obviously true. It seemed in the beginning to me, just when I was listening to that clip, that he seemed like he was trying to be nice but firm. But you say that the other detective, the one that was truly nice, got Nicholas. What did he get from Nicholas that night?
Say that question again.
What did the detective get out of Nicholas that night? What did Nicholas tell him?
Mm-hmm. So they immediately launched into this story that Gypsy had been kicked out of her mom's house, that they did not know what happened, that some unknown person went in and stabbed the mother to death, and the detectives in each room said, that is total BS. That did not happen. Mm-hmm. You were the last person in the house. There was not even a question that these two detectives, very seasoned ones, we're going to buy that story. So,
right.
Basically, you know, the detective, and I should know her name, but she just said, you know, Gypsy told us everything. She said that you stabbed the mom. And so there's this scene mm-hmm. in our film, I think it's at the very beginning, where he says, you know, I'm going to be honest with you, I did stab her mom. And so, like, that's where the film starts, because it is not mm-hmm. an unclear fashion of who murdered D.D. Blanchard. But the question is why. And so next, the detective wanted to find out, was Gypsy implicated in this murder, and why did it have to happen like that? And also, like, what is the cognition level of this guy, Nicholas? When you hear him talk, he's not put together completely. I don't, you know, it's a very sort of, it's very difficult, because I do believe, you know, that Nicholas is severely mentally ill, and, you know, I think that he was manipulated.
And Gypsy was convicted. She got 10 years, if I remember
right.
correctly. It's interesting, because I believe they were going to charge her with first-degree murder at the beginning, or they were thinking about it. But
right.
the hell she went through. And I'm not saying that it was okay that Nicholas killed her mother, Dee Dee, or anything like that, but you have to take into consideration what Gypsy Rose went through. Her life is done. It's over. She never had a childhood. She probably won't have much of an adulthood. Don't you think you have to have some compassion for her when you go in and think about prosecuting her?
I completely agree. I have a tremendous amount of empathy. And, you know, I had the pleasure of getting to know Rod and Christy, her dad and stepmom, and, you know, they love her and care about her. It would have been so, so easy to say, you know what, I'm not getting involved in this. This is horrifying. I can't do it. But they continued to show up for that girl and just say, you know, we don't care what you've done. We love you and we care about you. And so, yes, we can question the integrity of the statements made by Gypsy, but nobody knows what it's like to be held prisoner in your body for that many years. I can't even begin to imagine. I really hope that the film does reflect that, you know, while she might be an unreliable narrator, she is somebody that should be treated very kindly and, like, we should be thoughtful towards. We just don't know what it was like to be her.
The film, from an outsider watching it, like just a normal everyday person, absolutely it comes through. And she does deserve sure. our empathy. And it is great that her dad was not this drunken, violent person like her mom claimed him to be. And thank God they are there for her. And I am hoping that when she gets out, that she'll live with them and try and have some sort of life. Let's go back to Nicholas. What exactly was mm-hmm. he convicted of?
So he hasn't been convicted yet, actually.
Okay.
He is facing
okay.
a bench trial in the murder of Dee Dee Blanchard. Right now, it's being questioned, you know, basically, you know, if he can withstand trial. You know, it's been a very long, slow process, very confusing process for him. You know, we very much expected him to be figured out by now in terms of his legal status, but it has not.
Mm-hmm. How old is he? Was he 17 when this started?
No, he's older. He's in his late 20s.
He's older, okay. Oh, okay. Yes. And so Dee Dee was in her 20s as well. You've obviously
but
see, gotten
but
to know...
his mental level...
Gypsy.
His mental level is more like a child than an adult, though. He might be a certain
right.
age, but, you know, he's very mentally ill.
Yeah, his cognitive skills are not that sharp at all. And again, that needs to be taken into consideration as well, and I hope they certainly
right.
do. Because of this incredible film, you have gotten to know Gypsy Rose,
right.
and you've spoken to her since. Tell us your thoughts on her, your last conversation. Just open up about Gypsy and your thoughts, please.
Of course. You know, I find Gypsy endlessly fascinating. I think that, you know, whenever we have conversations, I want to hear about what's going on with her in prison, what's going on with with her studies, with how she's doing at work. You know, but I think that there is no ending of things that we can talk about in terms of what happened in her childhood. You know, she's very curious about the documentary. She hasn't been able to see it. The warden said no. That's pretty typical. You know, when you're incarcerated, they get to decide if you can or cannot see the film or the series. But she is she's playful. She loves her dad. She loves her stepmom. She loves her her stepsister and brother. I mean, she seems young, but I think if she were on the show and, like, you know, she's far more interesting than me, you know, she would be seen as very articulate, very young but very articulate.
I think her voice, her high-pitched voice, adds to her appearance of immaturity. I'm wondering if Gypsy Rose Blanchard, I've been saying it wrong, I've been saying Blanchard, but it's Blanchard, correct? I'm wondering if she's better off in prison than being in prison with her mother. What do you think?
You know, I do. I agree with you. I think that it is, you know, I think that she was under a constant threat of physical violence when she was in her mother's house. And so while I'm sure prison, there's a lot of very intense things that's going on in your brain while you're inside, she doesn't have to live under the threat that, you know, a feeding tube is going to be put in her stomach or that her mother is going to put medication while she's sleeping.
Or shave her head or stick her in a wheelchair. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So, Bessie, my great producer, you had a question. Go right ahead.
Well, I was wondering, Erin, in your communications with Gypsy, well, I know she has to be careful, you know, what she says, but do you think that she harbors any guilt?
You know, I think she does. I think that it would be very unusual if she did not harbor guilt. You know, I think that she does think that it was a survival tactic, that she would have been ultimately killed by her mother if the ruse had gone on longer. But that doesn't mean that she doesn't miss her mom, that, you know, it's like Stockholm Syndrome. You know, she doesn't know how to feel about it. You know, I think that it's just, it's so complicated.
Yeah, I think that's a good word for it, Stockholm Syndrome. I'm sure she felt that because over the years, you know, they developed this kind of symbiotic relationship where she did enjoy certain privileges that she wouldn't have otherwise. So, yeah, it is, I can imagine it's very complicated, and she must feel very conflicted. My heart goes out to her.
Definitely.
What?
And it's just like, you know, when we're looking at – or sorry.
No, you go ahead. You're more interesting than me.
When we're looking at these cases, you know, on the forum, when we're looking through and we're kind of searching through things, we're looking at Facebook, I think it's, you know, it's really important to recognize these people as people, as human beings. And, you know, they're not characters in a narrative play. And I'm not suggesting that anybody that is listening right now thinks that way. But it was a very continual process for me as I was approaching this story, as I was thinking about how, you know, how we told this story. I worked with a wonderful editor named Andrew Kaufman. You know, how do we get to the fractured humanity that is at the center of this story? True crime is important. It's interesting. It's so watchable. I listen to so many podcasts, but like at the heart of it, it's about human beings. And so like that felt really important to me, that you got to know Gypsy, that you got to see her sweet side, you know, in the limited amount of time that I was able to spend with her.
And on that note, Erin Lee Carr, I want to remind everybody again, the documentary, HBO documentary, Mommy Dead and Dearest, will debut on May 15th. and it's one day after Mother's Day. Very, very interesting choice of programming dates, like you said earlier, Erin. Absolutely brilliant. Erin, before we go, what's next for you? This is quite a documentary. I'm sure you'll be working and doing PR with this for quite some time, but down the road, what's next?
So I'm so lucky and so grateful to HBO. They have agreed to work with me on a third movie, crime case, of course. And so I will be filming a trial soon. It's a trilogy of sorts. I will continue to be thoughtful about these stories. So I'm working on a third film, and then I'm writing a book for Random House that will be published in 2018-2019.
Well, Erin, you always have an open invitation to come back to Web Sleuths Radio anytime you have a project or a book or just to say hi. We love talking with you. We're so glad we found another spirit, if you will, in the true crime world. It's always good to connect up with like minds. We do appreciate it, Erin. And again, thank you for your time. Monday, May 15th, HBO, Mommy, Dead, and Dearest. Everybody's going to love it, Erin. It's going to be an amazing hit. I promise you that. Take care, okay?
All right. Thanks so much.
Take care. Bye-bye. Oh, Miss Bessie. That was just, that was an emotional, a very emotional interview for me, anyway. It was just, by emotional, I mean it was just jaw-dropping, just hearing, and I've seen the documentary, and let me tell you, we barely touched what's in the documentary tonight. We really barely touched it. There's so much more. You do not want to miss it. What were your thoughts, Bessie?
Well, again, it was just chilling, and to think that this poor woman, and I do consider her a poor young woman, who was used by her mother all of those years, and then she finds some escape through the internet, and I think that probably her mother wasn't tech savvy enough to realize that she could actually post on the internet without, without Dee Dee knowing. She finds someone who she thinks might be able to maybe, at first probably just be a friend that she could talk to, and I'm surmising that she could talk to, and then this person turns out to be someone with these, severe mental problems and multiple personalities, I believe Erin said, and again, she in a way is victimized by this crazy person. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's one of the strangest cases I've heard of.
And we do have all of... Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I'm really interested to see how it's going to turn out. And will he be convicted? And, hopefully Gypsy won't be convicted of anything or won't serve long jail time and will get the help because she needs so much help. Another thing that sounds really interesting from the notes that I read, I haven't seen the documentary, but from some of the notes that you gave me, that once she was out of her mother's care, that she escaped, and I hope I'm not giving him way too much.
No. But that, like I said, there's so much more. We could just go on and on.
But that she was okay.
Mm-hmm.
She
was
healthy.
Fine. She was fine.
She was fine.
Absolutely fine.
And then one more comment I have to make is that I have to in some way blame some of the medical community who just took her mother's word that, her mother would say, oh, she has multiple dystrophy, and that they didn't look further into her condition.
There is one doctor. There's one doctor that regrets not doing that. And that was actually, he was interviewed in the BuzzFeed article, I believe. And he's the one that Erin said, wrote the note that said there's something wrong here. But you're right. I mean, the medical community, they relied on Dee Dee Blanchard, that's how you pronounce it, I was mispronouncing it the whole time, they relied on her to be the historian for her daughter. And she was a terrible historian because she made everything.
Right.
You know, the thing is, you got to, if a mom comes in and says, hey, the kid's having seizures, you got to look into it. You got to do something. And
right.
It's a catch-22. If they don't do something and the kid is very sick, they'll get sued. So I feel for the medical community, perhaps maybe more training on recognizing this. Then again, you hear these terrible cases of mothers who did have really sick children, who did have to continue to take them to the doctor and the ER, and they're accused of Munchausen by proxy, and they're nowhere near that. It's just a very slippery slope. It's very fascinating. We have a lot to learn on, a lot to learn about it, that's for sure, that's for certain. But anyway,
oh,
Betsy,
sure
thank you for everything. Once again, you did all the heavy lifting. I appreciate you very much. And next week, I don't know. We've got some things in the works, and I know you're going to really love our show next week. But be sure and pass this show around. The link that you listened to it, that you got to it tonight, that link is still good after the show airs and it's uploaded. Just click on that same link and you can listen to the show. So thank you, Betsy, and thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thank you.
It is Web Sleuth Radio. Go to websleuth.com and join in the discussion. Don't be shy, okay? And we'll see you next week on Web Sleuth Radio. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Good night.